Hey, this is Brad. We're off today, but please enjoy this encore presentation of the Bradcast.
We take on the biggest challenge in history, we save the world, and we do it together. Do you think that would pull America together? I do.
I don't. But I say let's do it anyway.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No kidding.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. We're also heard in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, and Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. Up in Palinville, New York on WLPP, Grand Rapids, WPRR. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. In Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, in Janesville, Wisconsin on WADR, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com. Get well soon, Nicole. Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Coming up today shortly, it seems like it's been a while since we've had David Dayan on this program, Desi Doyen.
I think because it has been.
He, of course, is one of our friends and a longtime financial reporter and author, and now the executive editor of the American Prospect, which has done something pretty stunning. They have turned over their entire latest issue and their entire prospect.org website with it today to articles that look at the feasibility and the need for a Green New Deal from pretty much every aspect. With more than 20 journalists and experts and a few celebrities like Senator Jay Inslee of Washington and 350.org founder Bill McKibben, all ringing in with fascinating, smart, and in-depth coverage on our ongoing climate emergency and what can and or should be done about it.
Yes, it's really, really fascinating. I'm still plowing through it, and I would say that what I like the most about it is a window into the future. Into a heroic future where we actually can succeed, and here's a roadmap of how to do it.
Some might call that a fantasy, Desi Doyen.
They might call it that, but you know what? Everything has to start with figuring out how you get there. And like I said, this is the idea of how we make this work, how we solve climate change.
David Dayan, who is not necessarily a green guy, by the way. It's not like he's an environmental activist or really journalist himself, but he may now be after putting out this landmark effort by the feisty, nonprofit, progressive magazine that he's now taken over as executive editor. So I will look forward to that conversation shortly. Very quickly, though, setting aside whatever may happen in the ongoing impeachment of Donald J. Trump, things are not going well for congressional Republicans of late, no matter how much they may be doing their best to pretend otherwise. Got a number of items along that line before we get to David, including some news that is just breaking as we go to air. So let's start here. The Republican exodus from Congress continues this week with still more GOPers opting out of running for before 2020 for some odd reason, which is weird because they keep telling us that impeachment is a disaster for Democrats, citing redistricting in his home state. Another House Republican has decided to not run for re-election in 2020 today. Congressman George Holding of North Carolina. He is the second GOPer this week to announce he's getting out. While the getting is good, In a statement on Friday, Holding said that his district had become more Democratic on the congressional map, and that factored into his decision. His announcement makes good on a promise he made earlier this week that he would not run again if he did not think he could win, and that he would not encroach on a reliably Republican neighboring district, which is already held by a colleague of his. So this comes about because North Carolina's congressional districts were recently ordered by the state Supreme Court after the U.S. Supreme Court said that they didn't want to have anything to do with this. So the state Supreme Court ordered that the state be redrawn after years, a decade, in fact, of racial and partisan gerrymandering by Republicans in North Carolina who controlled the state legislature, drawn to ensure that even though the state is perhaps the most closely divided state in the entire nation, which, you know, went for Barack Obama in 2008, and then it went for Mitt Romney in 2012, and then it went for Donald Trump in 2016 at the same time that it elected a Democratic governor statewide. So incredibly closely divided. And yet, despite that, Republicans have redistricted the state, mapped the state so that they were able to hold 10 of the state's 13 congressional seats for the entirety of the past decade. So now the state is being ordered redistricted for the 2020 elections, and Republicans are seeing the writing on the wall, at least Holding is, in his district. Now that it will no longer be protected with a partisan gerrymander to ensure Republican politicians get to pick their own voters versus, you know, voters getting to pick their own politicians, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, or whoever they may choose.
So he realized he couldn't win on a fair map.
That's exactly right. So he said, yes, the newly redrawn congressional districts were part of the reason I have decided to not seek re-election. He said in his announcement that he would not be running next year. I would say it's probably the entire reason he's not running. Under the new state maps, Holding's second district will shift largely towards the Democrats. Daily Coast Elections calculates that had these maps been in place in 2016, this particular district would have gone to Hillary Clinton by some 24 points in 2016. So I guess this guy doesn't even want to try to win there. Trump won the previous version of this district by 6 points, according to Roll Call. Holding is now the 18th Republican to announce his or her retirement from congressman while not announcing a bid for another office this election cycle. He is the second one this week, with more such announcements that, are coming just as we go to air here. But before I get to that one, let's go to the other one this week before Holding. That was Congressman Tom Graves of Georgia, of the battleground state of Georgia. He announced he would not seek re-election this coming term either. The House's GOP caucus has seen a wave of similar retirements over the past several months, most notably coming from Texas Republicans, and which, you know, Desi Doyen's old home state is quickly becoming a battleground state like it was when you used to live there.
Oh, yeah.
Many years ago.
Gerrymandering has really messed up representation in Texas.
So, okay, so that's 18 for the moment who are dropping out and not running. At least it was an hour or so ago, but that just changed before air today. It started this morning when the House Ethics Committee told Congressman Duncan Hunter, who had pleaded guilty in his criminal fraud case this week, that he needs to stop voting, at least in Congress. The committee chair, Democrat Ted Deutch, and ranking member Kenny Marchant, a Republican from Texas, sent a letter to Duncan Hunter laying out the House rule mandating that convicted lawmakers, quote, should refrain from voting on any question at a meeting of the House or of the committees of the House unless they have been exonerated or reelected after their conviction. Now, despite being indicted prior to last year's election, along with his wife on 60 counts of fraud, conspiracy, campaign finance violations related to his use of campaign money for a whole bunch of personal stuff, from the mundane, like buying groceries, to the extravagant, like vacations, to the appalling, like buying stuff from a country club pro shop for himself that he then billed as campaign contributions to veterans' charities. And by the way, Duncan Hunter is a veteran himself. Despite all of that and those indictments coming in last year, Republicans in the 50th Congressional District in California, down in San Diego, actually reelected this guy last November, as he complained that the entire thing, all of those indictments by Trump's own Department of Justice, was just a witch hunt. Sound familiar? Also, New York Congressman Chris Collins, he was indicted last year as well on fraud and insider trading. He claimed the same thing. This is all just a witch hunt, until he won re-election and then shortly thereafter pleaded guilty to the charges, just as Duncan Hunter did this week when he was allowed to plead guilty to just one felony count rather than the 60 that he was charged with. Pretty good deal he got there. Hunter, in any event, was informed today by the bipartisan heads of the Ethics Committee that he should not vote in Congress anymore. They said in this letter, this provision of House rules was promulgated to preserve public confidence in the legislative process when a sitting member of Congress has been convicted of serious crimes. They warned Hunter that while the rule is not binding, quote, you risk subjecting yourself to action by the committee if you violate it. That after Tuesday, when Hunter pleaded guilty in federal court to one count of conspiracy to steal campaign funds after he was indicted for using some $250,000 in campaign donations on personal luxuries, including, by the way, extramarital affairs. So he and his wife were charged for using money that he used to pay for his extramarital affairs. He's going to be sentenced next March. He faces up to 5 years in prison. Well, as of this morning, he was said to be in D.C. discussing his next steps with Republican leadership. Well, we now know what that next step is as we go to air here. CBS News' Ed O'Keefe posted a brief statement from Hunter just before air, reading, quote, shortly after the holidays, I will resign from Congress. It has been an honor to serve the people of California's 50th district, and I guess steal from them. And I greatly appreciate the trust that they have put in me over these last 11 years. The misplaced trust, I should say.
Why wait? Why not resign now?
Yes. Yeah, why not resign? Well, he's got to, I don't know why. He's just going to wait till the holidays.
Keep getting that paycheck.
Yeah. Okay, so that is 19 now from a caucus that is already down by about 33 or 35 at this point, I forget. 19 of those Republicans are now leaving. And as of this week, it's also not looking good for a potential 20th. This one from Kansas. Kansas, you remember, the home of Secretary of State Chris Kobach, the voter fraud, champion?
Chief fraudster.
Fraudster, yeah. Well, pretending he ran on two terms as Secretary of State, claiming that he was needed to stop voter fraud, to stamp it out across the state of Kansas, where it was running rampant, and he was actually even able to get hoax the state legislature into giving him powers to prosecute people for voter fraud. The only Secretary of State in the country to have that. There's a new one in there now, and he's also Republican, I believe, said, I don't want that power. So he's given that power back. That said, in Kansas Congressman Steve Watkins, according to the Topeka Capital Journal this week, his signing of a Kansas voter registration form and two other election documents declaring his residential address was a UPS store in Topeka could, in fact, constitute felony voter fraud under federal law and election perjury under state statute, according to officials this week. Shawnee County, Kansas records show the first-term Republican listed his official residence as 6021 Southwest 29th Street in Topeka. Well, that's nice. Sounds lovely. But it turns out that is a UPS store. When he signed a form to change his residency for voter registration purposes in August, he signed that as his address. He also signed that same address on an application for a mail-in ballot in October, and he signed a document to complete early voting for the November elections, again, using that address, a UPS store, which in Kansas is illegal, is actually voter fraud. It isn't clear where the congressman physically resided in Kansas after August, according to the Capital Journal, nor what Topeka precinct he was actually legally qualified to be part of when he voted in November. By asserting his place of residence to be the UPS store, Watkins left the Topeka City Council's 5th District for the City Council's 8th District. He then cast the November ballot in the 8th District contest, which, by the way, was decided by just 13 votes.
One of those was his. Illegally cast, it sounds like.
Well, his chief of staff disagrees with you, Desiree. Mm. Jim Joyce said questions about the residency issue posted by the Topeka Capital Journal led to a staff review of the congressman's voter registration, and he said Watkins mistakenly portrayed his residence to be the UPS building. Apparently, he made that same mistake three different times on three different voting-related forms, every time under penalty of perjury.
Lots of mistakes there.
A bipartisan contingent now of Kansas politicians is critical of Watkins and the way he's handled this. Several of those Democrats and Republicans said they suspect Watkins' acts rose to criminal conduct. State Rep. Blake Carpenter, who is a Republican, was among lawmakers who called for an official investigation based on a sense that Watkins committed multiple felony offenses. He said, unless I'm mistaken, no one can live at a UPS store. It cannot be a place of residence. Carpenter, by the way, serves on the State House Elections Committee. Again, in a state where for the last near decade, they have been lied to by their now disgraced Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, that there was rampant voter fraud going on, that they had to institute photo ID laws, that they had to institute proof of citizenship laws, almost all of which, by the way, were struck down by the courts as unconstitutional. And in the bargain, Kris Kobach, who represented himself in these cases, was actually slapped with fines by the judge for his for lying in court about this case. Three documents were signed by Watkins and were all obtained by the Topeka Capital Journal showing that he used this residential address falsely. This, a guy who moved from Alaska in September 2017 to Kansas and somehow ended up being a congressman there without even having an apparent house, a residency at this point. Katie Kupel, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Kansas, said state law necessitated that every person registering to vote in Kansas identify a residence. She said the state had allowed post office boxes to be used in some very rare instances in, for example, rural areas where not every home actually has a formal U.S. Postal Service address. She said the voter registration makes very clear that individuals who provide false information could be subject to perjury. And now that's up to the local authorities to decide how they move forward with those situations because, well, the Secretary of State no longer has the power to prosecute as Kris Kobach did when he was there. Do you think that he would have prosecuted a sitting member of Congress?
Kobach,
Des, had he?
Somehow, I don't think he was going after Republicans in his
Not
searches.
Republican members of Congress.
Right.
Let's see. This could constitute a felony punishable by up to 7 months in prison and a fine of $100,000. That's under state law. Under federal law, he could go to jail for 5 years. You could face a $10,000 fine. And, you know, we have seen people be charged and penalized with much worse for doing much less than what this guy did. And as a member of Congress, there is a presumption in court that this guy would know what the laws are. So he could be, or at least he should be, in trouble. He ran, by the way, in 2018 in a seven-candidate GOP primary. He claimed 26% of the vote, and then he defeated the Democratic candidate by just 1% of the vote in his particular district. His father contributed more than $1 million to his campaign, but apparently couldn't give him the money for, you know, to rent an apartment somewhere to at least pretend that he lived in the district. So right now, there is no declared Democratic candidate in the 2020 race for this particular Eastern Kansas district of the U.S. House. Well, WTF, Democrats, get to it. This is a seat held by a voter fraud criminal dude who is said to have won last year by just 1%, and there's no Democratic challengers already lining up to take on this guy, a guy who they would be running potentially on the same ballot with, guess who? Kris Kobach, who is now running for U.S. Senate after losing to a Democrat when he ran for governor in 2018. Yeah, he's running for the U.S. Senate. All told, by the way, Kobach secured about 10 convictions in his 8 years as Secretary of State, promising to break up this massive voter fraud wave that was going on in Kansas. He got 10 convictions, mostly from people who broke the law because they owned two different houses, like a house in Kansas and in a neighboring state like Colorado, and they voted during the same cycle in both places. And by the way, in most cases, they didn't know they were not allowed to, and they voted in elections that, you know, where they didn't vote twice for president, for example. There was a local election here and a local election over there. Somehow that is still illegal. And Kris Kobach fined these people, again, many of them Republicans. They were fined $5,000. So now that he's running for U.S. Senate in Kansas, I'm sure he'll be demanding that Congressman Watkins be locked up right away, right? So it's starting to feel a lot like 2006 again, at least to me, when one Republican after another is getting caught up in some criminal scandal or just quitting. But in 2006... Republicans still held a majority in the U.S. House before they were then overtaken by a Democratic wave election that year. Now, Republicans are already down 30-something seats. So next year could be interesting. They could become swamped at this point in November if these Republicans keep up the good work. In any event, getting swamped at the polls, that's one thing. Being swamped by rising seas and worsening storms is a completely different matter. And while Republicans might not, like talking about this, and they might prefer to ignore these realities, there are too many Democrats and, frankly, folks in the media who have been ignoring them as well. But not the American Prospect. At least not anymore. The executive editor of The Prospect, David Dayan, joins us next to discuss their latest landmark issue devoted entirely to our climate crisis and whether a Green New Deal might actually be able to save us all. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the broadcast. That Grateful Dead would be the theme song for the fossil fuel industry. Don't let that deal go down. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Financial journalist David Dayan's piece last month at the American Prospect, where he is now the executive editor as well, is headlined "The Biggest Threat to Financial Stability is the Climate." It begins this way. Every few months, a news outlet will write a story heralding the next financial crisis with an assumed assuredness that we should all view as suspect. Predicting the next crisis has become a sport, he writes, one that typically magnifies risks and displays an unreasonable degree of certainty. But if you had to choose a looming event that's most likely to produce a negative shock to the financial system, it would almost certainly be the climate emergency. Citing a recent report from Greg Gelsenis and Graham Steele, both former longtime members of the Senate Banking Committee, Dayen warns that huge risks to global financial stability will flow from a warming planet and the efforts to mitigate it, but that federal banking regulators have gone almost completely AWOL in monitoring or even assessing this legitimate threat. Worse, he writes, to the extent that any financial regulators in Washington are paying attention to the climate crisis, they're seeking to dismiss it. A subcommittee, for example, formed at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, to look at climate-related market risk is stacked with fossil fuel industry representatives, he writes, including several executives from climate-polluting agribusiness, banks with significant carbon-intensive portfolios, and fossil fuel giants BP and ConocoPhillips. That's right. Those are the folks in Washington looking to help us all assess how much of a threat their own business and investments might be to the economy. I wonder if they'll be sounding the alarms that non-fossil fuel-connected advocates have been ringing for some time. The committee's clear intent, Dayen explains, is to examine the climate risks to polluting companies' core business, not from their polluting. But it's not just the threat to the economy represented by our worsening climate crisis. There is also a serious threat to the economy from, yes, taking action to try and correct it. The costs there are huge and enormously disruptive as well, at least to the world's current fossil fuel-centric economy. Our financial system seems to be whistling past a climate graveyard, Dayen warns. Financial firms are so deeply implicated in fossil fuels that any disruption, a physical one or a financial shock that reprices carbon assets, as climate advocates are warning must be done and must be done quickly to save civilization, any such financial shock will cause widespread suffering and potential catastrophe, and these risks could manifest at any time, he warns. That disturbing and damned if we do, damned if we don't warning from Dayen at the American Prospect was, as I noted, from a week or two ago. And it wasn't even included, for reasons that I can't frankly explain, from the in the magazine's breathtaking new issue, released on the web on Thursday at prospect.org, devoted entirely to the politics and policy of a Green New Deal, featuring in-depth stories from more than 22 reporters, experts, and climate leaders in what I am personally only just now cracking into and probably will still be through the holidays and perhaps beyond. So here to walk us through this landmark achievement with a bit of a preview is the aforementioned David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect. Oh, David, welcome back and congratulations on this important new and long overdue issue of the magazine, sir.
Thank you so much. I really am proud of this achievement.
Mm-hmm.
We really saw a gap in on the progressive left. We had this, you know, the Green New Deal as a slogan has gotten us further than practically any kind of climate initiative has in the previous several years. However, we thought there was a gap in translating it into policy and showing that it's not only urgent, but it's practical, and it's feasible. And it not only can be done, but it must be done. And so we set about to explain that, collecting the best experts and reporters that we could find to really lay it out on every segment of the economy, every obstacle in its path, and how we can actually get from point A to point B and do this thing, the limit temperature rise.
And I want to step through some of those pieces, but you know, as I think you know, David, Desi Doyen and I have been producing our Green News Report here, 6-minute radio feature, going on 11 years now. So we cover this stuff pretty closely. And we've had many years of complaints about the corporate media not taking this issue with the gravity and focus that it deserves. And I got to say, in all of these years that we've been covering this beat, this is really the first such comprehensive, serious attempt that I've seen to do exactly that. Was there one particular thing or one particular moment that led you to say that we need to do this?
Well, I think, and thank you for that. But I just think that we saw a gap in the marketplace. I mean, we are a small independent nonprofit. Mm-hmm. We don't have the resources of a New York Times or Washington Post. But what we can do is identify where there are these gaps, where there is a need for understanding, a need for reporting. And then flood that zone. And that's one thing that I've tried to do since I started 6 months ago with the Prospect. And it definitely informed this project. You know, that we're talking about our planet. We don't have a choice but to make this work. And we were genuinely relieved, because when you start a project like this, you hope that, well, I wonder if this is going to be practical, if this is going to be something that can be accomplished. And, you know, it was a pleasant kind of surprise when we went to Jeff Sachs and Marina Mazzucato and Mara Prentice and all these experts and said, can you actually get this done? And they said, yeah, and I'll tell you why. So you know, it was genuinely rewarding to see it all on paper, that it's laid out in a very, I think, easy to understand way, that we have the technology on hand today to move to a carbon-free economy, and that carbon-free economy will not, you know, sink global GDP growth, but actually enhance it, and it can equalize our economy. It can create jobs, and especially in places. Benefiting those who were hardest hit by the toxicity of the environment to this point.
Well, it may benefit them, but it may not benefit those who were responsible for that toxicity, and that might be the holdup here. You know, as I noted, I want to walk through some of these pieces, but you mentioned in introducing it that you wanted to examine whether and how you could practically accomplish a transformation of the planet to limit temperature rise, and whether the Green New Deal that was introduced by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey in the Senate, whether it is realistic, practical, and necessary. Sounds like, well, I think we all know that it is necessary, but you're suggesting through this report, through these reports, that it is both realistic and practical?
Absolutely. And we lay it out step by step. You know, Ed Markey, we actually held a launch event with Ed Markey on Capitol Hill. And he held it up and said, "This is gonna govern my thinking on this from now on. This is the blueprint."
Right.
We were really honored that he would do that. But we go through it step by step and we break it down. So one of the things I love is we show the role for cities. We have Joan Fitzgerald writing about how cities can contribute to a Green New Deal. We have Governor Jay Inslee writing about how states can and will contribute to a Green New Deal. And then one of my favorite parts is we have two stories by Nelson Lichtenstein and Kevin Baker, who are historians. And what they write about is they look back to the original New Deal, and they see what lessons can be drawn from that over to the crisis that we have today. You know, the crisis of the Depression was a powerful economic and social crisis. The crisis we have right now is a climate crisis. And what linkages are there between putting together a New Deal in the 1930s and a Green New Deal in the 2020s. And there actually are many. Number one, on the financing. Kevin Baker calls for sort of an updated version of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to fund a Green New Deal using public money, using public financing. Nelson Lichtenstein has this wonderful piece taking you through the history of how, you know, there was this element of participatory democracy within the original New Deal and how that can be applied to a Green New Deal to get people comfortable with this idea. There's another article we have by Jeff Foe about the maybe the biggest political obstacle to a Green New Deal being the fact that faith in government has been whittled down to a nub in the Trump era, and how you have to restore that before you can say, yeah, we're going to put together you know, a $6 trillion plus program from the government to you know, green the economy. You're going to have to come up with some rationale to say that government can get this done. And one way to do that is to start and build from the bottom up and involve people and engage people in the decision-making process that will make a Green Deal, New Deal happen. Well, so, you know, I think we've covered as many angles as we could hope to cover through these pieces, and I really have just scratched the surface here.
Since you cited the historians' take here from Nelson Lichtenstein and Kevin Baker and looking back at the original New Deal, one of the things that strikes me about that, of course, is that that was predicated on an already existing financial disaster that occurred. In other words, if anyone had tried to do a New Deal, FDR's New Deal, you know, 10, 20 years earlier, I doubt it could have ever happened. Are we looking at something similar here where we are going to have to actually wait for a crash, wait for the worst of the disaster before we actually will find the political will to take action in this particular crisis?
Well, I mean, I think Desi would tell you that that disaster is already here.
Yes, I am here, and I would definitely say the disaster is already here. And the effort to combat climate change is actually, and I believe the addition will underscore this, but the effort to combat climate change is actually less expensive than the expected disasters we will see from climate change.
Well, but
you're talking about the cost of inaction.
Well,
and that cost is very steep.
And I want to get to that because you speak to that specifically in your article in a moment. But the environmental catastrophe is already here, but not the financial one, at least not yet, that, you know, precipitated the original New Deal. I mean, are we going to have to wait for a, you know, a financial collapse before we have the political will? Because right now, you know, all I hear is the economy is doing great. It's never better. Donald Trump is getting rid of regulations. We've got clean air, clean water, he tells us, and everything is just fine. So,
I mean, we're going to have to do the political hand-to-hand combat on that. And I think it does start with understanding that government has a role to play, which you know, that's, you're talking about rolling back the Reagan Revolution. If you have to start there, right? Mm-hmm. So this it's going to take time, and it's time we don't really have, but it's critical to start there. I hope that it won't take a financial catastrophe to get us to the point where we need to do this. And you know, I mean, the good news is that we have presidential candidates that are on board and understand the scope of the emergency and the need to act quickly and to use executive authority if need be. You know, we have the ability to change the power plant mix, to put regulations in, to restrict carbon from a command and control level through the Clean Air Act. And if that's what has to be done, that's what we're going to need to do, right? It's, you know, obviously the election is going to be a huge part of that. Mm-hmm. And also bottom-up activism is going to be a huge part of that. We have a piece in here by Marsha Brown, one of our writing fellows, about Extinction Rebellion, which represents sort of a new stage, a new phase in climate activism that along with, you know, the climate strikes, the youth climate strikes, Greta Thunberg and that, which is really about direct action, taking it to the streets in a way that we haven't seen in the past. And Extinction Rebellion is doing this in a very unique way, and I think that if you're going to get the powers that be to understand the enormity of this without a financial crisis, it's going to take the largest and most powerful and important social movement since the civil rights movement to actually get that motivation and that energy going. And so we do write about that as well in the package.
And that's one of the things, I mean, aside from what the solutions are, presuming that there are solutions that could still be implemented to mitigate the worst of effects of the crisis that we are already in, the two big hurdles seem to be the financial hurdles, and you're saying that, well, we'll talk about that in a second, actually, and the political hurdles. And Marsha Brown writes about Extinction Rebellion. I see that Jeff Foe is writing, "Will Americans Support a Big Green Government?" That, to me, what's the answer there? Will Americans support this? I know that it might take an Extinction Rebellion type of, uprising to force it, but what were your writers finding as far as whether this is even, I guess, politically feasible?
What I think,
because it sure doesn't feel like it, David.
Right. No, your frustration and your skepticism is warranted, frankly. What I think we set out to do here is to look at this thing not as a slogan, but as a practical policy. And it's easier to then go out to the public and say, support this thing, and here's what it will actually accomplish. If you have that blueprint, rather than if you have a slogan and there's not a lot of meat on the bones, and it can be distorted and demonized in various ways.
Right.
So we set out to create a fact basis for the idea that a Green New Deal is realistic and urgent and reasonable and feasible. The politics, and this is always going to be what this always runs up against. The politics are going to be really darn hard on this, and we're going to have to renew sort of the idea of government as a part of the solution rather than part of the problem, as Ronald Reagan depicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't have. If I had all the answers to that, then I think we'd be in a much better position. But I think it starts with that educational aspect, to build out the idea that, yeah, we can do this, and to give people ammunition when they're in these debates that say, instead of saying we have to combat climate change and we have to do it now, they can say, well, look, in the American Prospect, what I read is that we can do this for less than 1% of GDP globally, and it will have this huge return on our investment. It will reduce corporate power. It will increase participatory democracy. It will help those who have been most affected by this emergency and by this crisis, and we can get this done, and we have the capabilities. So, I think the issue puts us in a better position to fight on the politics.
You and your optimism, what happened to you, David Dayan? Let's take a quick break here. Speaking with David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, about his surprisingly hopeful special issue of The Prospect dedicated to the Green New Deal. Quick break, and we're back with more because I want to ask him about some of these financial numbers that he points out in his own contribution to all of this. After a quick break, I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. We'll be back soon. We just want to make the world dance. Forget about the price tag. We can't forget about the price tag. Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. To many, the price tag seems to be the only thing that matters. I'm speaking with David Dayan, the executive editor of The American Prospect and the author of 2016's Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. So he knows quite a bit about, global financial collapse. And to that end, he wrote an interesting article in The American Prospect in advance of their special issue just out this week on the Green New Deal, which includes reports from some 22 reporters and experts and climate leaders looking at the Green New Deal and whether it is actually realistic, practical, and necessary. And I think the answer he's explained to us in the previous segment is yes, yes, and yes.
Right.
And with all of that in mind, David, your article on the climate's threat to global financial stability was not quite as optimistic as the rest of this.
What I would say is that it throws the subject into relief. I mean, there are all these claims that this is a boiling frog problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to sneak up on us, and we're not going to realize that we're in this trouble because the costs are far into the future. And I think what that the article you described is talking about is that the costs are actually here, and now we have this almost vice grip situation where there are costs to inaction, and there are now costs to action.
Yeah.
Because we can talk about that, but it's basically because the financial regulatory apparatus mm-hmm. has not paid attention to this issue for so long that they've now have a financial system that is embedded with carbon assets to such a degree that changing the mix of those assets is going to cause financial shock.
And you make the point that you make actually a lot of disturbing points, I find, in this article, but that there are some efforts by central banks in other nations to work together to figure out the cost of transitioning away from a petro-based economy.
Right.
But our own central bank, the Federal Reserve, arguably the most important globally, is not even a member of that global working group.
That's right.
And that, I guess, we have no such official inquiry of our government even going on right now to look at what these costs are likely to be?
That's the serious problem here, is that the Federal Reserve has not taken this seriously. All of our bank regulators pretty much have not taken this seriously. Fed Chair Jerome Powell at mm-hmm. a hearing essentially said that Congress has given that authority to other agencies. He just basically mm-hmm. begged off the question entirely. And that is a serious, serious problem. The Fed and, by extension, the other banking regulators are supposed to look at the safety and soundness of the U.S. and global financial system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question that significant temperature rise is going to cause serious weather events that will affect major financial assets, anything on the coast,
mm-hmm.
To a significant degree on the one side, and that if you reprice carbon, you're going to have stranded assets in the trillions and trillions of dollars
right.
in the portfolios of major money center banks on the other side. And so for the Federal Reserve to beg off this question and say that other agencies have it covered, it just courts disaster is what it does.
It courts disaster, not unlike what we saw that you write about in your book, Chain of Title, what we saw in the 2008 global financial meltdown. But here you've got, as you underscore, you got sort of tens of trillions of dollars conservatively that it will cost. That's sort of the cost of not taking action before we hit the point of no return in this matter.
Right.
And then, as well, paradoxically, there's the cost of actually taking action. That would also cost tens of trillions of dollars. It kind of seems like we're screwed either way, David. Damned if we do, damned if we don't.
Which are we most
or least damned, I guess, is the question at this point.
The point is that these other central banks have, have figured this out, and they have this network for greening the financial system
mm-hmm.
to do, you know, I mean, because you could see this trillions of dollars, which is a big number, over a very long time horizon, over 30 years, 40 years. And if you work now to auction off these assets to move and transition the economy and sort of get this priced in to the financial system, there is a way to do this gradually such that it does not cause like an immediate near-term shock where there are fire sales and people going crazy. The problem is the lack of attention to the subject on the part of U.S. regulators.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a global network they could plug into very easily and get this going. But, you know, financial firms aren't going to do it by themselves, right? They need that push
apparently,
from the regulators
yeah.
to force them into this position, even though it's their keisters on the line, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we start changing the mix of energy assets, and, you know, J.P. Morgan and Bank of America have all these fossil fuel assets on their books, they're the ones who are going to be screwed, right? So
mm-hmm.
they should want to work constructively to figure out a way to you know, get this ticking time bomb diffused.
But
so,
but they're not. I mean, this is why you call it whistling past the climate
it's
graveyard.
Short-term thinking that says, you know, in the financial crisis, there was this acronym, IBG-YBG. It means I'll be gone, you'll be gone. And what it means is that when this all blows up, we'll be you know,
yeah.
6 feet under, and who cares? So that's kind of the thinking that's going on right now with respect to climate and the financial system, and that has to change.
What could or should financial regulators actually be doing here in the U.S. if they were addressing this with the seriousness that it deserves?
Sure. I mean, the first thing is actually figuring out where the risks are. Like the Securities and Exchange Commission could require all public companies to detail their financial risks from climate change. They could say, you know, the banking regulators could essentially give a stress test
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, if carbon price went to this level, what would your portfolios look like, and how could you, you know,
mm-hmm.
come back from that? And once you do those kinds of actions, then presumably the system will figure out, well, we better get on the move and try to figure this out. Financial companies could be supervised over their climate preparedness. That could be part of the examination system. They could force companies who have higher, you know, carbon-sensitive assets, that have large portfolios of fossil fuel assets, they could force them to carry more capital to absorb losses so that the taxpayers don't have to absorb them. So there are a lot of things that can be done. It's just political will and understanding that this is a major threat.
Is it something that you see, presuming Democrats can win back the White House next year, and that's a pretty big presumption at the moment,
sure.
but taking that presumption, is this something that you see Democrats, do you have confidence that Democrats will do exactly this? I mean, we waited to have these stress tests for the banks, you know, until after the catastrophe happened. Do you suspect they will add stress tests on their, you know, carbon-related investments to their oversight?
I think that was the point that Graham Steele, who was a former Senate Banking Committee
mm-hmm.
Staffer with Sherrod Brown,
mm-hmm.
and Greg Gilzinis, who worked for Jack Reed, and is now at the Center for American Progress. So this isn't coming from the loony left, right?
Right.
This is from the center.
Right.
That's why they wrote this thing. They feel that these nominees are going to be have to be held to this, you know, this is going to have to be part of the mix of nominating and confirming the next financial regulators. What are you going to do on climate? And if this issue can be sort of raised in the public consciousness now, it prepares people for 2020 and beyond. If a Democrat gets into the White House, that this has to be part of a comprehensive Green New Deal kind of agenda
mm-hmm.
that you can't just change the transform the energy mix of the country and leave it at that. You're going to have to pay attention to these financial matters.
I'll point folks to your article, David Dayan, at the American Prospect, headlined "The Biggest Threat to Financial Stability is the Climate," where you also include a scenario that sounds very much like, you know, the way AIG fell apart and how that right. affected the entire economy when things went south during the global recession of 2008 that we should be looking at in advance. So when you go to the American Prospect, to prospect.org, to look up that article, you will also find this extraordinary issue on the Green New Deal with some 20 different articles. The entire website right now over there at Prospect is dedicated to this, thanks to,
And by the way, even after we change our homepage, you can find everything at prospect.org/Green New Deal. That's all one word.
Very
good. Prospect.org/Green New Deal, and you can find every single article that is in this special section.
Last question for you, David. What is your hope that Americans will take away from this special Green Prospect issue?
Well, I hope that they can see the Green New Deal as a policy, as not just, you know, a pie in the sky kind of wish and a hope, that a practical, reasonable, realistic, and urgent policy. That this is not just a blueprint for something we can do. It's a blueprint for something we have to do. And so hopefully the takeaway is that we now understand what needs to be done and what can be accomplished. Now let's go out and do it.
That's the unusually hopeful and optimistic David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect, which, by the way, is a nonprofit organization. It relies on reader support to continue this important work. Please consider supporting their efforts with a subscription this year. Get one for your crazy MAGA uncle just to drive him crazy. I suspect, David, you don't care. They need the support if we're to keep, you know, independent, important journalism like this going right now at perhaps the most perilous moment we've ever seen in both this country and this industry. So please consider that. David Dayan, always great to have you here. You can find his work, of course, at prospect.org. You can follow them on the Twitters at The Prospect. And you can send your complaints straight to David on the Twitters at D Dayan. Thank you, brother. Really great to talk to you again, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, we got to get out. Thank
yes.
you very much to our producer, Desi Doyen. I think I know what you're going to be doing over Christmas.
Oh, yes.
Reading The American Prospect.
All of it.
Also, thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. All of that made possible by those of you who support our work at bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.